Welcome to Healthy Intersections for November 2023. I'm Lisa Lines and the host of this podcast. I'm also one of the senior health services researchers at RTI International, an independent nonprofit research institute. And I'm also one of the editors of Medical Care Blog, and that's where we're hosted. So if you're listening to this on Spotify or Apple Podcasts or anywhere that you get your fine podcasts, I want to encourage you to go to our blog to see the video that comes along with this audio. We're going to be having some really fun interactive map displays today. So I hope that y'all will go to our website, themedicalcareblog.com, and subscribe so that you'll hear when we come up with a new episode. And with that, I'd like to welcome our guest on the podcast this month, Zach Dyer. Welcome, Zach. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Well, I'm so excited to talk to you. For the audience, just so you know, we are both people who did our PhDs with Arlene Ashe, who is one of the leading lights in health services research and applied statistics and mathematics and risk adjustment, and absolutely one of my heroes, one of the best experiences I could have possibly asked for to have gone through my PhD with her. And I know Zach, you also worked with Arlene for your PhD at UMass Chan Medical School. Tell us how you ended up there, and how did you get to that program and end up working with Arlene?
It's kind of a, but I'll tell the shorter version of it. But I grew up in Worcester.
Oh, wow.
I grew up in Worcester. Grew up going to UMass Memorial as my hospital,
Wow.
where my pediatrician was. And I kind of always knew I wanted to go to medical school, but after undergrad, was really, or during undergrad, really got interested in public health, and decided I wanted to kind of dig into that a little more before I applied to med school. I did my MPH in Boston, which brought me back. I was commuting from Worcester, so I was back in Worcester. Did not expect to be, I thought it was just a brief time I'd be back while I was doing that. Degree. And then as part of that, I ended up doing a practicum with the Worcester Division of Public Health, which turned into a job, which turned into me being there for about 5 years. And as I was applying to medical school, I kind of knew a lot of the researchers at UMass in the Clinical and Population Health Research Program, which is the PhD program that we went through. And yeah, I think there was a lot of hemming and hawing for a little bit, but I ended up deciding to stay, and I'm very glad that I did. And I get to kind of be connected to all the work that I was doing before, and also do new things and learn new things. And I should say I'm an MD PhD student, so I said medical school, even though we both did PhD at UMass, but I am a MD PhD candidate, and I've finished my PhD a little more than a year ago. So just finishing up the MD now. But and I as I was starting my PhD work, I had done a lot of community health work at the time in Worcester, and felt like I knew that area of public health, population health really well. And I said, I want to get into kind of bigger policy questions, and ended up working with the MassHealth ACO evaluation team, and Arlene is part of that. And that's kind of the road my research was heading on for a while, and still applying the kind of social determinant, health equity lens that I had been working in, but to that work. And then the pandemic hit, and I shifted my focus a little bit. And I think we were having a lot of conversations about changes to the system, and the system being a broad the system, kind of all systems. And I said, I really want to pursue this for my dissertation research. And Arlene was very supportive, and it lined up with the work that she was doing. And that's how I ended up working with Arlene. And I'm so glad that I did. And I think it's really, I've learned so much from her, and continue to learn so much from her. And I think the work we've done together is great, and I'm something I'm very proud of.
As you should be, it is great work. It is fantastic work. And so not only were you doing your PhD during the pandemic, you were also working at the Department of Public Health there at Worcester, right?
It was a kind of an awkward time for me because, and I guess maybe one of the reasons why I think I shifted my focus a little bit was that, I was in medical school up until fall. I was doing the kind of medical school portion of the MD PhD up until fall of 2019, then started the PhD portion. I was in my first year when the pandemic hit. Hadn't really been engaged in Worcester Public Health for a little while. And I suddenly found myself in this position where I wasn't kind of part of the medical system that I had been in very recently to be able to, help out with what was happening there. And I wasn't directly in the public health system. And I'm a doer, so I felt very paralyzed in that I wasn't able to kind of help out during the pandemic. And I ended up kind of finding other things, but I think it was that discomfort that led to me shifting my focus and thinking a lot more about equity and anti-racism. And then after I finished my PhD, I did go back to the Division of Public Health for a year. I took a leave of absence from school, went back for a year, and helped them kind of transition out of the pandemic or into kind of our new normal. So I did that in 2022, yeah, until this fall.
Quite a journey, and I'm sure that your work is really profoundly influenced both by what we've all been through, but also the experience of just seeing it right up front in front of you. I'm also a doer, and I think the impetus to do something is a really, really beneficial and powerful kind of place to come from. And in my case, growing up poor and growing up in kind of really desperate circumstances informed sort of my wider feeling about inequity and poverty and the influences on us as we're trying to be healthy but are blocked by so many things that helps and really harms in our places where we live. There can be great assets and then a lot of not so great things. So I wonder, as we start to transition and talk about your work some more, can you give us an idea about how you came up with this piece of work we're going to be focusing on today? I would like you to introduce it.
Yeah, and it was a conversation that we were having, or a few conversations that we were having at the time. Arlene and her research team had developed the neighborhood stress score,
Yes.
and something that MassHealth uses in their risk adjustment payment models. And it's a pretty simple measure of neighborhood stress. It uses seven variables from census. And we were comparing it to the Area Deprivation Index, which is widely used. It's available across the country. The NSS is just available in Massachusetts. And we were noticing that there are really big differences in different areas. And one was in Boston. And I'm familiar with Worcester, so I can kind of look through Worcester neighborhoods and say, like, this makes sense, but this doesn't make sense. And then I had also studied in Boston, knew some of the neighborhoods, especially around Boston Medical Center. I'm saying
Yeah.
the this what I'm seeing isn't making sense for these two different scores in kind of either direction. Like, what is behind this? And we started to dig into it. And at the same time, we were having a lot of conversations about racism and anti-racism and kind of how we often let the root causes of the social determinants of health go unspoken. And there's just so many different things happening at the same time. We're looking at these measures. It's during the pandemic. We're having a lot of conversations about equity and racism, and trying to really, commit ourselves to looking at things differently. And one of the thoughts that I had during that time was, if we approached these measures from a place of recognizing that racism has shaped so much of the different, the distribution of these social determinants, I bet we'll do a better job, of, tracking health outcomes or, well-being and, prosperity, that if we can, you know, start from that place, and kind of move forward from there and use that as our tool or our framework to pull in different information, different data about neighborhoods, then we'll have a better sense of what's going on. So it's kind of a lots of different conversations, and it led to that point. And that's when we started talking about the tool that we now use, or that was part of my dissertation research and is now kind of published and available, which is the Structural Racism Effect Index, or SREI. Either way, it's a mouthful, but it started, you know, in 2020, our conversations about it, and it's great in 2023 to see it out in the world and being used. Yeah.
I have that same feeling. We've been on a very parallel journey, in fact, as you may know.
Yeah.
And Arlene and I have been, you know, in conversation along the way. And I think she said that the idea to compare to life expectancy was shared sort of between our projects. So I think we've actually been definitely doing similar work in terms of collecting as much data as possible and creating an index across the whole US. So let's go ahead and have a look at the map that you've been, that you've released. I mean, I'm so impressed by your publication in Health Affairs. We'll put a link to that in the description for the podcast. And hopefully folks will also be able to go to see the SREindex.com.org.com.
Yeah.
.com. Okay. All right. Yeah. Straight up.
Yeah. And I'll go ahead and pull it up here. Yeah. So like, can you see that? It's always,
yes,
it's years and I still ask the question, are you seeing my screen?
Yes.
So this is the homepage for the, Structural Racism Effect Index. It's SREindex.com. It's a very simple website at this time. Just really, mostly is there's a map and there's the data to download, and some extra information about methods. But there's a link to the Health Affairs article here. I think if anyone wants to kind of understand how we, you know, built this, that's the best source of information. But I'll go ahead and pull up the map here. I think, you know, something I didn't talk about is that, you know, one of the conversations that we were having, thinking about COVID is how important neighborhood is, and kind of what, how the resources that are available in your neighborhood are so important to, your overall health, and prosperity, and really shapes a lot of health outcomes. And we were seeing that very clearly in COVID, where, you know, two towns or two neighborhoods right next to each other were having vastly different outcomes. You know, the thing I always say is that it's to see a infectious disease, a viral illness, a novel viral illness, follow the exact same pattern as chronic disease prevalence, tells you something that should you know, raise an alarm, as, you know, there's something else going on here. And we decided, you know, we believe that neighborhood is really kind of the unit where a lot of the different policies, you know, racist policies and decisions about how resources are distributed kind of end up. Neighborhood is so important to that conversation, and that's kind of how we approach this. I'm going to pull up Worcester, of course, the map here, I'll say for those of you who can see it, the lighter areas, I'll zoom out, the lighter areas on the map are where there are the greatest effects of structural racism. So, you know, we see a lot in the Southeast United States, but really everywhere in the country, you'll find different pockets. And the darker purple areas are where there are the least effects. And you know, we think of it kind of as resource rich. So those areas that are kind of more deeply colored are correspond to the resources that are available. So if we zoom in on Worcester here. You can see there's a pretty wide variation in the different scores. Of course, there's wider variation in other places in the country, but if we click here on maybe oh yeah on Union Hill, this neighborhood here, it's going to pull up information about it. It's going to give you the overall score percentile. And then there are nine different domains that are a part of the Structural Racism Effect Index. For those of you who are listening and can't see it on the screen, it's built environment, criminal justice, education, employment, housing, income and poverty, social cohesion, transportation, and wealth. And we got those domains from kind of looking at the structural racism literature and asking how are other people measuring this really difficult to measure concept. What sources of data are people looking at? What are the different areas? And trying to make as an exhaustive list as possible and seeing kind of what buckets they fall into. And this is these nine areas are what we were able to find and then also have data to back up with. And there are a lot of indices out there that do similar things. But some of the I think most novel domains that we have are criminal justice for sure. And maybe social cohesion, but our approach to other domains is also a little different. On the website, when you click, you'll get the kind of information, the scores in those nine domains, the score for the SREI, the national percentile, kind of where it ranks, and it also gives you life expectancy, and then the ethno-racial composition of that area on the website as well. And yeah, it's available for almost every census tract in the country. About I think 99% of the population is covered by an area that's scored, and all of the data is available to download from our website.
Fantastic. Yeah. And it's coming from publicly available data. There's no proprietary anything in here. And what you've done, your methods are pretty straightforward. You've oriented everything in the same direction so that higher means worse. Is that correct? Okay.
That's correct.
And so the higher the SREI and that ranked percentile score, I assume that's what that is. The higher the disadvantage.
Yeah, we say the higher the effects of structural racism,
Got it.
or the more compounded the effects of structural racism.
Got it. I'm curious now if we would like look at yours and ours like side by side. I imagine we would probably see very similar things because we do have very similar domains, and similar measures. But your methods are quite different. So tell us about your methods. Again, I thought they were pretty straightforward, but so for a lay audience, how did you put this together?
So like I said, I first identified those different domains by looking at the literature and seeing what other people were measuring when they thought about structural racism. We came up with those nine domains, and then we said, okay, what's all of the publicly available data that we can find that fit into one of these domains? We started with, I think, the most commonly used source of information for these type of indices, which is the American Communities Survey from the Census Bureau. And there are a lot of reasons to like that. There's a lot of information in there, and information's available at the census tract level, and that's the kind of our proxy for neighborhood that we use. I don't know if you use census tract or block group in yours. I don't remember, but those are usually the two choices that people go with.
Tracked for
And
sure, yeah.
yeah.
Well,
and
I
then
mean, the
we
big thing is they don't change except every 10 years. So.
They don't change. And because especially the American Community Survey, because the their estimates for the most part, they're good estimates, but they're estimates. So the smaller geography you get, kind of the broader or the less sure those estimates are. So we want to get as narrow and granular as possible without with while still feeling like the data was pretty accurate and pretty stable. So we looked at the American Community Survey, kind of put all of those different variables into the buckets of our nine domains. Then we looked at other federal data sets, and we found a lot of good information there, from measures of segregation that the federal government's using to retail job availability or foreclosure risk, is something that housing and urban development from the federal government is measuring and reporting. And then the last kind of place we went was to see, you know, in these nine domains, are there other publicly available sources of data that people are reporting on in the literature? And it didn't yield too many, but it yielded, I think, some really important ones. One is eviction data, which is included in housing, the housing domain, and the other criminal justice. Well, no, sorry, most criminal justice data comes from the federal government, but some of it comes via another another organization. So we ended with, I think, 42. And some of them had, you know, enough kind of data issues that we just couldn't end up using them. One of them was that I really wanted to, because, you know, it's an area that I think is pretty central to when you're talking about structural racism, was voting data. Mm-hmm. And there just wasn't a good way. You know, we started with census tract. You won't find anything by the census tract. And then, you know, there are precincts. Mm-hmm. I tried to go at the precinct level and couldn't find, you know, one state or a collection of states might have good data. And the most kind of consistent source we saw was at the county level. And we really tried not to use county level data. I think we did end up using it for some of the criminal justice data, but for the most part, tried to avoid county level data. But it's one that I still, you know, every now and then I still just, I'll spend a night, you know, trying to see if I can work with the data enough to get it workable to be able to put into it. But I haven't so far. So
I wonder if you can talk a little bit about your definition of people of color for your structural racism effect index.
Yeah. So I'm going to stop sharing this because that won't give us too much information. Yeah, and it's a good question, and one that we talked about internally a lot, as my dissertation was getting prepared and then when you were going to publish in Health Affairs. So one thing I should say is that for the most part, the SREI is race neutral in that it has no explicit measure of demographics in it. And that's different than some other indices like the SVI, which has, you know, percent Black and percent Hispanic as reported by the census, and, you know, maybe percent people with a disability. We intentionally did not want to include that data in our index. The only place where there is some information about the racial composition or ethno-racial composition of a neighborhood is when you look at segregation. So there is a kind of composite segregation measure that looks at three different measures of segregation. One is comparing white and Black populations. One is comparing white and Latina populations. And then one is a more general type of segregation measure. It just looks at how different ethno-racial composition is between areas. So that one variable is kind of the one place where there is some information. But if you just looked at that number, you wouldn't really be able to tell exactly what's kind of happening in a neighborhood. In the validation of the paper, we did define people of color. We wanted to make sure that our index correlated in some way to the number or proportion of an area that was people of color. Because it's measuring structural racism, we'd expect that to be highly correlated to the ethno-racial composition of a neighborhood, but not always. And to do that, we defined it as, and in the paper, it gets very specific about kind of what categories using the census data, but it is anyone who identifies as Black alone or with another, some other race, anyone who identifies as Native American, American Indian, or Indigenous alone or with some other race, and anyone who identifies as Hispanic or Latina as the ethnicity in the census. And there's a lot of conversation about that. And I'll let you ask the question about it, but that is, you know, I'll start by just saying, when we think about the long history of structural racism, I think there are a lot of different types of, you know, structural racism doesn't look the same for all populations and for everyone, and it affects everyone in different ways, including, you know, white Americans. We wanted to start from kind of two I will say, starting places of racist policies, and that being slavery and kind of American colonialism, imperialism, and how those policies perpetuated in different ways throughout history. And that's where we started. But I will let you ask a very important question.
So I live in Long Beach, California. We have little Cambodia here. Here in California during World War II, the Japanese were evicted from their homes and businesses and interned. So, there are people here who have suffered from the racism inherent in wars. We've invaded a lot of Asian countries and bombed them, and there was certainly a lot of racism involved in that. So, to my mind, I do think, that for inclusivity and for fairness, it would be better to consider people of color as a more inclusive definition, including people of Asian descent, because, it's a very broad brush. And I think even people that we might consider high status or white equivalent or whatever the nonsense is about that, there are still effects of structural racism inherent in our history, in the Chinese Exclusion Act, in the racist determination that Indian people or Sikhs were not white. So many different things in our history that I would be remiss if I did not say that I do think it is an omission in the paper. And I am curious about, how you ended there. I mean, like, what was the deciding factor? Was it just because of, your intention to sort of go back to the 1619 project?
Yeah, it had a lot to do with it. And I think I'm glad you asked the question because it lets me talk about something I didn't get to talk about in the paper a lot. Talked a little bit more in my dissertation, which is like the categorization of ethno-racial groups is at, I think is at the heart of this question and this problem of who are we including and who are we not including. I personally, I'll also say, personally, the term people of color, I think is not always useful. And if I could in every place in the paper, actually, I don't know in the health affairs paper, I think we only talk about people of color once or twice. It's in the, definitely in the graph, in one of the graphics. I prefer to be much more explicit and say, you know, Black, Latino, and indigenous populations. The ethno-racial categorization that we use that comes from it doesn't come from the census. I'm blanking on where it actually comes from. The different part of the federal government, but comes from the federal government and is used in the census, and that's kind of the basis that everyone uses when we think about race, is not great. It's not
No.
very, very reflective of how we actually how ethno-racial groups or racialization actually happens in the country. And there's even I think this is one of the lines that sadly got cut out of the paper as you're cutting words, but
Yeah.
the Census Bureau itself released a white paper. It has over 10
Ironic.
years ago. Yeah, maybe white paper.
I never use that term anymore. We published a blog post about it. We're like, no, we shouldn't be using that term anymore.
Maybe 5 to 10 years ago, that said, you know, we're not doing this right, and here's a recommendation to be better at it. Two of the recommendations were to stop thinking of, well, there you could go in two different directions. So one was to kind of stop thinking of Hispanic, Latine as an ethnicity separate from race because it didn't match people's self-identity. That's not really how people were identifying, and ended up that they were, you know, a lot of the people who are checking other. Was because of that distinction, and we weren't properly catching that. Another was that Middle Eastern, Northern African, and that's an area that you, I think, appropriately point out that excluding Asian from the category people of color doesn't make sense. And I also think that Middle Eastern, Northern African, excluding them from people of color, also doesn't make sense. And it's hard to know exactly what kind of box in the census is being checked. And I think in that paper, they actually go into that. Some of it's a lot of it is white. Some of it is other. It's some of it's Black. It's hard to know. And you know, I think the term Asian is so broad and includes such a huge portion of the world who have vastly different experiences, just like white, just like black, just like Latine, that it's really hard. I wish we had more granular data or that could be more true to the history of kind of how especially if we're looking at what is happening in the US, kind of what the history is of people, how they came to the US and what that story was. And I think the broad brush that we do paint is okay, for the most part, we know what the history of the majority of Black Americans is and what that kind of history has been. And I'll say there are some notable exceptions, and what I pulled up on the map is actually Worcester is one of them. The Black population in Worcester, there are two distinct Black populations in Worcester. One is recent African immigrants, and
Yes.
the other are kind of descendants of American slavery. Those are very different histories. Might experience similar interpersonal racism on a day-to-day basis, but have had very different kind of generational histories and lives. And I think when we I mean I'm guilty of it too in this paper of saying these are the categories we're using, but when we categorize people so easily, I think we miss a lot of that difference and can obscure some of the injustice that continues to happen. And Latine is another. There's actually a few different kind of histories there that I think we see that have similar threads and overlaps a lot with kind of American Indian Indigenous history that is part of those original sins that I was talking about of slavery and American colonialism imperialism. All of that to say is that's kind of how we landed, and I think anything that we do with our current data will be imperfect. And that is, we landed on an imperfect answer to a question that is yeah was difficult, and we talked about a lot. But I'm glad you asked the question.
Well, I'm glad we have the limited discussion that we have time for. Unfortunately,
Yeah.
we don't have unlimited time, but I wanted to say that, I mean, in terms of race and ethnicity, one of the things that I think is really, really tricky nowadays, anyone can take a DNA test and know exactly what their DNA says that their ancestry is. There are a lot of surprises that have come out for people. A lot of people who were told that they had Native American ancestry, for example, doesn't come out. A lot of people who weren't told, it does come out. And, that North African piece, I mean, how many, I mean, if you really look at the DNA, we're 99.9% the same anyway. I mean,
Yeah.
this race thing, it's a social construct, and it's a way that our country has used to, police behavior and enforce caste
Yeah.
distinctions and do all kinds of awful things in the name of this idea. So I'm with a lot of other people, and that when it comes to the healthcare system, we have so far to go in dealing with the effects of structural racism and seeing things from a with a wider lens, and and really understanding the causes of the causes. Being Black, being African American, that is not a risk factor. That's not the risk factor.
Yeah.
The risk factor is the racism, and I'm glad that you all have, really focused on structural racism for the SREI. It's really great work. One of the other things, just to say, about that piece of it, about, the census, the biggest increase that we saw for the 2020 census, because we just got the detailed results that just got released, was people of Cherokee descent. 700% increase from 2010 to 2020. So,
I hadn't heard that. That's very interesting.
it really is. So, when you think about like all of the things that go into what we're talking about with this issue of structural racism, and I think a lot of people really feel American is, in a sense, a multi-ethnic identity, and the growth of the multiracial category on the census, I think, is another recognition that it's not black and white. It's not even black, white, and brown. It's so much more complex and nuanced. So I'm glad we had this chance to talk about that. And I think one maybe other thing that we could chat about really in the last couple of minutes of our conversation is just this idea of people imputing race and ethnicity. I know you work with a lot of data, and a lot of times I work with data where, survey data or other data where we have linkages between different kinds of data sets. And a lot of times there's missing race and ethnicity. So we in Massachusetts, all payer claims database work that we did, 60% missing race and ethnicity. Now it's, I think, down to 50%. So in that situation, a lot of people will do things like create an algorithm that will guess at, probabilities that this person is one thing or another, which, we've had the conversation, Arlene and I, and we've had this conversation in other settings on the blog and in the podcast, but I want to just give you an opportunity to talk about that as well, because I bet you've thought about it.
I have, and it I think links a lot to the conversation that we were just having. And I am going to bring it back to that SREI is,
Yes.
one of the biggest questions I have when that happens is, what are you using that data for? Like, what is the purpose of having that data about that person? And a lot of times we'll include race and ethnicity in a model or in the way we're in research, and don't think we do not properly discuss it. The proper way of discussing, I'm putting this, people cannot see this, race as a risk factor in quotes,
Yes. Scare quotes.
is people's experience of racism. That is really the risk factor that we're talking
Yes.
about. The access to resources that people have, and we're using race as a proxy for that. And I think if you are, we could spend 45 minutes just on,
I know, right?
I think it is kind of inherently problematic. But I think if you ask the question of what is this information for, and what am I hoping to achieve with it, there are possibly other solutions out there. One solution might be to look at the neighborhood that someone lives in and say, not like, what is the ethno-racial composition of this neighborhood, but what are the resources that are available in this neighborhood? Use a tool like the SREI to say, there's a high concentration of the effects of structural racism in this neighborhood. This is a risk factor. The experience of structural racism is a risk factor for anyone who lives in this neighborhood. That I think is a power of a tool like this, that you don't have to confuse those two concepts. You can include both in a model. You can say, I know where someone lives, and this is the experience of living in their neighborhood. And also, for whatever reason, you have to conceptually figure out why you're including someone's ethno-racial group in that model, and I think be able to justify it. I think we always just throw it in, and it's fine. But you really, I think, need to conceptually justify why you're including that. You can use both, and I think you should, if there's a tool available to tell you about the experiences of racism, in terms of resources, then that should be used. You shouldn't just have to rely on imperfect data about ethno-racial group, and then make it up when you don't have that available to you.
I mean, it has very big equity implications to make it up or to guess, and guessing wrong definitely has implications. We don't want to, aim for health equity and end up with more inequity. And that's exactly what that kind of approach can actually lead to, the unintended consequence, in my view. And I think the research, the evidence base would actually back that up.
And I think it perpetuates a idea that ethno-racial group is kind of inherently linked with these other things that we're looking at, whether it's the outcomes that are used for imputing or whatever else people are using, that it and it doesn't look the same everywhere.
Well, on that note, thank you again for taking the time out of your very busy schedule, Dr. Dyer.
I'm happy to chat and be able to make this connection between our parallel work that's happening. So
Yes, absolutely. All right. Thanks for listening and viewing, and see you next month.